Hey, I'm Hendel Leyva, and welcome to the Immigration Mike podcast, where we take you through the journey and story of every guest and the personal reason why they're fighting for immigrants across the nation in their own way. Find all Immigration Mike interviews on Apple Podcasts now. Here's what's going on in the immigration conversation in 20 seconds. This past week, former White House Chief of Staff John Kelly broke with Trump on a number of immigration-related policies, including family separations and sending troops down to the border. And he also said of immigrants, they're overwhelmingly not criminals. They're people coming up here for economic purposes. I don't blame them for that. Basement thoughts and top floor dreams. I don't want a thing if this is not for me. I don't want your shoulders and I don't need your pity. I just want to shine, want to put on. It's the week of March 9th, and today we have an interview with Daniela Vieira, who is a self-described dreamer, hip-hop artist, an immigration and education advocate, the founder of MassDreams.org, and was part of the album American Dreamers, Voices of Hope, Music of Freedom, which won 3 Grammy Awards just a couple of weeks ago. Here's a sample of the amazing production and vocals of her work. Go to iTunes or Spotify and type in her name to hear the full songs. I'm trying to find my way on, 'cause I've been lost for too long, and I don't know if I belong anywhere. I'm stuck inside my own head, I'm stuck inside my own head, and I need someone, come and stay inside with me. You don't even know when the whole hype is over, where your ass about to go. But for the moment, let's just be honest, the way you do me feels like I'm wanting. Okay, so we'll talk to Daniela shortly about her story, her advocacy, her music, and her experience being on stage at the Grammys and much more. But before we get to it, the best way to support the podcast is by your rating and review on Apple Podcasts. If you leave a review, I'll be sure to read it here, just like this review from my friend Rosa Velasquez. When I virtually met Hendel, I thought it was just another journalist wanting to use my story for his benefit. Man, was I wrong. This was one of the most fun, honest, raw, and simply outstanding opportunities for me to lift my story and for him to use it as an advocate for us. I'm ever so proud of how far you have come. Can't wait to see where you go. Every one of these stories is powerful beyond belief. The way that Hendel interacts with his guests is so real, never speaking for them or putting talking points in their stories. Immigration MIC is a must hear for everyone. So that amazing review was from my friend Rosa. I'd love for you to support the podcast as well. Leaving a review is the number one way to support the show and its guest, so show your love. Here's how to do it in 3 simple steps. 1, open the podcast app on your iPhone and type in Immigration MIC. 2, scroll down to ratings and reviews and click on leave a review. 3, rate and write your review. And that's it. So when you're done listening to this episode with Daniela Vieira, go back and do this, and I'll read your review on a future episode. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Immigration Mike podcast. Today, I am so happy to have Daniela Vieira with me today on the podcast. We have a pretty cool way of the way that, you know, we actually got connected and this podcast came to be. I actually just spoke on the phone with her like a few days ago, and very quickly she was like, yes, let's do it. I'm down. And, you know, I'm really excited for all of you to get to know her. First of all, for her story, but also for like her creativity and her passions and her endeavors. So again, welcome Daniela Vieira to the podcast. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Yes, of course. So why don't we just start with how we got connected? So I'll just put a little bit out there and then you kind of tell me. So there was a journalist on Twitter who said that he was making a thread of like everyone involved in immigration or something like that. So I decided to post like, you know, the audiograms that I'm posting on the Instagram. And you followed me. Mm-hmm. So tell me how that looked like from your side.
Yeah, it's funny because I'm not even sure if I follow the journalist who posted the original tweet. Uh-huh. I just think one of my friends like responded to it. And so I saw the thread And I went through it and pretty much followed everyone who wasn't a lawyer, because there were quite a few people who were kind of just, you know, identifying as an immigration attorney. And I'm like, that's awesome. Good for them. But I already have enough lawyers in my life. I'm just looking for other people who are somehow connected to like this whole immigrant experience. And so you are one of the people I followed, and I didn't even do any of like follow-up work of, you know, after I hit follow on your account, kind of like spent some time figuring out who I just followed. But then you reached out to me and your comment was just like what I needed to hear that day, because you commented on my song. And that's always awesome, because I think sometimes like things are so compartmentalized where like I have people in my life who appreciate my story as a young immigrant, and then I have, you know, my non-immigrant friends who kind of know me as a musician, as a creative person. So it's always kind of cool when the two worlds collide. It was nice to hear that you listened to the song.
Yeah, and you know, I'll just say, we'll get into it a little bit later, but you know, the comment that I sent you was like, yo, I just wrote a remix to your song. And that's the truth. Like I sat here, like I just started the beat, and I was just like, I just started vibing, and like half an hour later, like I actually had 16 bars, and I was like, then I DM'd you and I was like, yo, I hope you don't think I'm weird, but like before anything, I just wrote a remix to your song and I want to get to know you. So so I think that's pretty cool. And we'll talk about that a little later into the podcast. Okay, so why don't we just get, you know, go into it. Daniela, you know, I would love to get to know who you are. So why don't you tell me, who is Daniela? Who am I speaking with today?
Oh, who am I? That's a heavy question. But I was born in Brazil. I have a great family, loving parents, loving sister. And my parents, I guess, they just have the immigration gene. They came to the U.S. when they first got married. They were like 23 years old. And this was back in the late 80s. They came to the U.S. and they had my older sister. And they lived here for like 2 years in Boston. And, you know, the way they tell it is like there really wasn't an immigrant community at the time. So while it was easier then to kind of do things like get a social security card and get a driver's license, because there was no anti-immigrant sentiment, there also was no immigrant community. So they felt really alone and they ended up going back to Brazil. And a couple of years later, I was born. So even growing up as a child in Brazil, like I knew that I had an older sibling who was a U.S. citizen, and my dad was unemployed like most of the time that we were in Brazil. So my parents were always sort of commenting on the idea of coming back to the U.S. and trying it out again, because the thought was just that like here in the U.S., if you're willing to work, like there's work for you to do. And so when I was 8 years old, my dad came to the U.S. again, and you know, we were left behind in Brazil. And a few years later, me, my mom, and my sister followed him. And you know, it's sort of like the typical story. We came, you know, my parents are categorized as unskilled workers, so it was not viable at all to get a visa or a green card. So we came as tourists and overstayed. And my mom, from the very beginning, she told me like, listen, this is what we're going to do, and it's going to be complicated, and we're going to have to be in like this unlawful situation for a while. But the idea was that because my sister's a citizen, it was like, it's only going to be a matter of time until she can, you know, petition my parents and then petition for me. And that's kind of what happened. You know, we lived our first few years in the U.S. as in an undocumented family. Like my parents are undocumented, I'm undocumented. So there's so like
Let me actually back up just a little bit.
You know? Sure, sure.
Because in this podcast, you know, I love to get in depth into the stories. So my question is, what decisions were made like regarding like leaving Brazil? For the U.S., like what factors were there? What was the motivation?
So first it was my dad. Like he didn't have work in Brazil. Like he just didn't have a job, and he, he was unemployed for like 12 years, and it's not like he's sitting around doing anything. So the economy was just really bad, and he felt, you know, just sort of like helpless. It's very frustrating to be someone who's like capable of doing work and wants to work and not be able to do anything. So it was first sort of his decision to come, and he felt like he could do more for us if he came here. And then once he was here and he sort of confirmed like in his mind that this is the place to be, like this is where I could raise my family with dignity, we started just planning like when are the rest of us going to go. And my mom sort of set, you know, she told my dad, like, I'm only coming this time if we have a reasonable place to live. Because when they first came to the U.S. and they were really young, they were, you know, they had like 8 roommates in a 3-bedroom apartment. And it was just really rough. So my mom was like, I'm not going to subject my children to that. So my dad, actually, before we joined him, like in the 3-year period that he was here without us, he bought a house. And once he bought the house, it was when my mom was like, okay, we're ready to come join you then. Mm-hmm. And I was 11 years old, and I was pretty excited because I had been like longing to be in the U.S. I felt like my whole life. And I also just like missed my dad. Mm-hmm. But it definitely became sort of like a heart-splitting, heartbreaking experience the closer it got, because I realized that like I was going to leave like my cousins and my grandmother and people who were very close to me behind. So it was a pretty intense day. Like I remember my little cousin is like my best friend growing up. And I just remember being at the airport and my family's all there, and he's younger than me. So he's sort of like, he knows I'm about to leave, but he didn't really know how to like express what he was feeling. So it was just like the two of us, everyone around us is like crying, and me and my cousin are just like playing like nothing's going to happen. But we kind of had this like awkward vibe, like, damn, I'm really not going to see you again. Like, that's crazy.
Right.
Yeah.
If I could ask, why Massachusetts?
Because if you remember, I said my parents moved here a long, long time ago when they were young and it didn't work. But back then, other people that they knew from our hometown in Brazil were also coming to Boston. And when my parents went back, these people stayed. And it ended up 20 years later, it became like a community of Portuguese-speaking people and people from Brazil, and a solid number of people from my neighborhood in Brazil like live in Boston. So when my dad decided to come, it was like, who could help you? He already knew people that were here that could, you know, let him house like room with them for a month until he got a job and could point him in the right direction and stuff like that.
Cool. Yeah. And you know, thank you for sharing that. And of course, like, this reminds me, you know, to give a shout out to Paloma Jovira, who you know, I'm going to connect you further with on Instagram, but you know, she was someone who did a live event at Framingham University in Massachusetts, and I just think it's amazing how things come full circle, because I think it's actually a year later since that event. And
really?
Yes, and you know, now I'm talking to you, and again, Brazilian, Massachusetts, just like her. So go back and listen to that episode if you have an opportunity. Okay, so back to you. So tell me about, you know, being 11 and beginning to grow up here in the U.S.
It's so weird because it was all very exciting but also like stressful at the same time. It was exciting to be it's just exciting to be like in an American school setting, because you grow up like watching Hollywood movies and stuff, and like in Brazil, we don't have like lockers on the hallway, and like you don't stay in school through lunch, like you go home for lunch. So all of these things that I had grown up like seeing only on TV like became my reality. Like here I was in a school that had like the hallways were lined with lockers. And
so I have to ask you, which movies are you referring to?
Just like every like childhood movies, like Home Alone and okay. Like Disney Channel movies. like everything with the Olsen twins. Like those were kind of like the things I pictured America to be like.
So I'm just gonna throw a fun fact out there for everybody. My youngest brother, his name is Kevin, and he is named after Kevin McAllister in Home Alone.
That's
So
funny.
yes, but
Yeah.
continue.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it's classic. So, and my dad bought a home in a town that he knew didn't have a lot of Brazilians because he thought that we would learn English faster that way. Like he was, because there is such a big community of Brazilians in Massachusetts, some of the schools you like, you don't even have to learn English to get by and like do fine. There was actually the year before we came to the US, there was still funding in the state of Massachusetts for bilingual schools. So kids who are immigrants, like they could take math and science classes in their native language. And there were, you know, good things and bad things about the program. But my dad was worried that like if we were surrounded by other people that spoke our same language, that we wouldn't learn. So in his best intention, he took us to this town called Draycott that's pretty, it's kind of rural. It's like in between a suburb and like a rural town. And it was pretty white. Nobody had really had a foreign language student in the school before. So it was like all very new to my peers and my teachers as well. And I got lucky because my principal was awesome. Like he kind of like made me feel like an attraction at school. Like he wanted all the kids to think that I was so cool because I was from another country. And so people like would ask me questions about my life and were very kind about like being patient with me and showing me around. And I remember I had a English as second language teacher, but like we didn't have a room. Like she would pull me out of the classroom for like an hour a day each day, and we would just sit in a hallway and she would kind of like give me the lesson. And today, that same woman, she's now the head of the English as second language program because now the whole town has one. And it's like this much more structured, like, you know, each school has their own ESL room and has their own staff, and she just oversees everyone. So it's crazy for me to see too how like my sister and I were kind of like the first ones. And then that town increasingly became diverse and had more immigrant families coming because it was considered to be safe and also cheaper because it's further out from the city. So today it's just like a very different high school demographic than what I experienced. But it was, you know, it was most of the time it was a pretty healthy environment for me, but it was also very hard because my parents always told us like, under no circumstance can you tell anybody that you're undocumented and that's for your safety and for your family's safety. So I just grew up with a lot of like secrecy and you become very isolated when, you know, you navigate all your friendships without being able to like reveal who you really are. So it was really hard. I really did not ever open up to anybody about my situation until my senior year of high school. So that's a long time to sort of like live in the shadows, as we say.
And so, during this time, you speak about isolation and how difficult it was. How are you unraveling as a person, before you got to, the end of high school?
Yeah, I think my first couple of years, it was just like really important for me to do well in school. Like that was sort of my identity. Like I wanna impress everyone because I didn't want people to think that I was stupid just because I didn't know English. Like that was really a concern I had. And so like I just dove into like my schoolwork and I was very good at math and science like right away because those are things that sort of translate easily. And I remember like the first time I finally got an A on a reading exam, like the whole class was like celebrating with me. It was really sweet. And, you know, eventually, like once I had a better grasp of the language, I was able to just like bring my personality back to who I was, like, which has always been like I'm an outgoing person. I like to bring people together. I like to have fun. I like to be silly. So that was like that's what I became known as. And then there was also like I've always played multiple instruments. So when the opportunity came at school to like be in the band and play an instrument, I picked up the saxophone. Like that was something I hadn't done before. But it was sort of like another fun fact that people like, I could be like, yeah, I play the piano at home, but at school I play the sax. And it was like another thing for me to be really good at, even though I had limited language skills. Like I did the music stuff very well. So as I went into like middle school where things are a bit more like, you know, kids aren't as nice. At that point I had already sort of distanced myself from like being a foreigner because that's what I thought I like needed to do to fit in and be like everybody else. And yeah, I think all through high school and stuff, like, I mean, like my friends, people knew that I was from Brazil, but it's not something like I talked about all the time. And my identity was much more like, I'm the girl who's good at school without trying too hard, but she's smart enough. And I'm like sort of cool, but I'm nice to everyone.
That as you're saying like, it, like, I just see that swag. Like, I see the swag in your shoulders. So
that's funny. Yeah. And, you know, I think, I don't know. I always knew I was smart, and my parents always told me that, and people around me always told me that. So I always thought, like, college for me was always, like, a given. Like, yeah, I'm going to go. But once I got to, like, my junior year of high school, and that's when my undocumented experience became more prominent to me. Like, other people still didn't know, but while my friends were getting their driver's licenses and they were getting jobs, like, I couldn't do any of that stuff. And so I had to ramp up my lying a lot more because people would ask me, like, how come you don't drive? Because it was obviously inconvenient to live in a rural town where there's no public transit,
right,
and not be able to drive to things. And, like, if I do sports after school, I have to wait till, like, 6 p.m. for my mom to come pick me up because I can't drive. And so a lot of doubt started coming into my head, like, how am I going to be able to go to school, and like, how much longer can I keep lying to my friends without them thinking like I'm weird or something's going on? And it just so happened that the summer before my senior year of high school was when DACA was announced. Mm-hmm. And it was like the summer where my doubt had gotten so big that I was like, oh my God, like, am I even going to go to school? And then DACA is announced, and my parents were just like, we don't even know what this means yet. Like, no one knows what this means yet, but we're still going to spend the summer like touring colleges, and like, you're still going to spend your time making a list of what schools you want to go to. And I think that's what's really special about my parents, is like, they didn't wait for things to make sense to encourage me. Like, they just encouraged me the whole time. Yeah. And they were like, that part we will figure out when we get there. And that's always been something I really appreciate about them, because I think there were people at the time who, with good intentions, like, advised them to, like, you know, tell Daniela to stop thinking about this stuff. Like, she should just, you know, she'll go to community college, or maybe she'll go to a vocational high school, and it'll be enough. Like, you guys shouldn't, you know, don't let her get her hopes up. But they didn't really care. They were just like, they saw me put in the work, and they wanted to make sure that somehow it was going to pay off. So they like played it normal. Like, the whole step of my college, like, research process, even though my parents had no idea what was going on, cause we had never gone through it, they wanted me to feel like as normal as possible about it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the end it paid off. It was really hard because since DACA was so new, when I applied to schools, like, none of the schools knew what that was.
Right.
And so it wasn't really part of the application process or like the questionnaire. So most schools, like, I just applied like a normal student. And so I started getting acceptance letters and scholarship letters. Mm-hmm. And I would like celebrate those achievements. And then down the road, the schools would come back to me and be like, wait, like, you can't have the scholarship because we don't understand what your status is. So I went through like that heartbreak a lot of times because I applied to 8 schools and I got into all of them. And most of them also sent me like a financial aid letter. And it was like, great. But then they like took it away. So it was just like a lot of times to go through that, like, wow, I did it. Never mind. You can't go. And in the end, it came down to me going to UMass Amherst, which is my in-state school, which in the state of Massachusetts would have been the most affordable school. But at the time, they were going to charge me out-of-state tuition. So it came down to that and Ohio State. And because UMass was going to charge me out-of-state tuition and Ohio State was actually giving me some merit scholarships, like they were the only school that let me keep my merit-based aid, I ended up going there. And it was so crazy because before that, like, my parents didn't even know where the state of Ohio was. And like, I know a lot of people who grow up like wanting to go to Ohio State, like they like fantasize about like the football games and all this stuff. But like, I had really never heard of the school. And so when I applied there, it was sort of like an afterthought. And it ended up being the one that I went to. And it was also the first time that my parents and I were apart again, like after sort of like reuniting with my dad. So it was a very like unique challenge and like new thing for us, but it ended up being like an awesome time.
Yeah. Wow. So you ended up going to Ohio State, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to ask you about that, but before we do that, I want to ask you about what was your perception of immigration in the news at the time? You know, leading up to that, like, what was your perception of the immigrant rights movement? Like, what did you see during that time?
So I remember, like, no one around me, like, no one in my high school was also an immigrant. So in that regard, I was sort of, like, isolated from the movement itself. But I do remember being in high school and there being talk of the DREAM Act. And I remember like Barack Obama's election, like my dad being like, you know, like maybe this is it. Like maybe now that this is the president, there will be some sort of legislation. Like I always heard my parents talking about the possibility of some legislation that I would benefit from, that we would benefit from. And the most distinctive thing I remember is like in 2010, like I remember watching C-SPAN when they had a vote on the DREAM Act and it failed. Right. But I was never really connected to any of the people that I now know were like advocating for that bill to even be brought to a vote. Mm-hmm. So I really was not even aware of any movement until I think the first sort of like immigrant activist or like personality I heard about was Jose Antonio Vargas. Mm-hmm. The summer I graduated high school, I was at my friend's house and I saw that her parents had the Time magazine. And I remember seeing like the headline, like no papers or whatever. And I was like, what? And so I looked him up afterwards and like through his story, like heard of other people who are like openly talking about being undocumented. So that was kind of my introduction to knowing that people like that existed. Mm-hmm. But I really did not learn about the work that was already being done and did not get involved for myself until like my sophomore year of college when, one, I started realizing that there was a lot of barriers that I was facing that like people around me were not facing and that I needed to find support.
What were some of those barriers?
Like just being undocumented at school, I told you how like Ohio State let me keep my merit aid scholarship, but every year you have to do like your financial aid stuff. And towards the end of my freshman year, when I'm like doing all my paperwork for the next year, there was this whole mess where OSU was like, wait a minute, maybe you're not supposed to be having these scholarships. And some of my aid got taken away from me. And like none of my friends knew that I was even in like this like tumultuous situation. And I just like had no one to talk to. And like, I didn't know what was going to happen when I applied for internships or, you know, what is even going to happen when I get my degree? Like, am I going to be able to work? I don't know. And DACA was so new and we just didn't know like what the hell was going to happen to it that I started feeling like I needed to find other people that were also in my same shoe. And so I looked for them at school and I eventually found them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I found myself with this community of like 6 or 7 other DACA recipients in this university of 60,000. And once, you know, the election started coming around and Donald Trump starts saying all this stuff and being in Ohio.
So this was recent, like.
It was like 2015.
Okay, recent enough, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, being in Ohio is very different than being in Massachusetts when it comes to, like, political stuff because I had never, like, I had met ignorant people in high school, but I had never met people who were so openly anti-immigrant. And I saw those people, like, on my campus. So became even more important for me to sort of build that community of support. And there was an event at Ohio State they do every year called Latino Role Model Day. And I like volunteered to just help like set up the chairs or whatever. And there was a panel of Latino students and I knew none of them were undocumented because at this point, like I was pretty confident that I knew all the undocumented people on campus. And they bring like all of these Latino high school students from the Columbus area. And it's for most of them, it's their first time ever being on a college campus. And somebody in the audience asked like if they thought undocumented people could go to college. And the panelists, like, I almost like wish they didn't say anything, but I remember like the panelists tried to give some sort of answer like, I mean, I don't know because I'm not undocumented, but you know, here's how I make it work. And I'm listening to this and I was just like, no, like I have to go up there and answer this question. So nobody really knew me, like the people organizing the event didn't know me, but I just walked up to the stage and this lady, Elena, who's now one of my biggest friends, she's like, do you want to say something? I was like, yeah, I do. So I answered the girl's question and I was like, I'm actually undocumented. And that was the first time that I like said that in a room full of people. And it was really powerful because later Elena told me that that high school student like reached out to her to say that like, wow, I never thought I could go to college, but like that really motivated me. And I think that was sort of like the beginning of my spark for advocacy and just for being involved because I realized that there's like value in doing that and like really concrete ways that it helps people to like see themselves where they want to be. So from there I just started doing more stuff with my undocumented peers and sharing my status with like close friends.
So I just want to say that, you know, this is a pretty powerful moment of being empowered, I would say.
Yeah.
That you walked up, you know, you had the information, you know, you got the mic, and then like, you know, that empowered someone else, you know? So I just wanna kind of like hone into the fact that, you know, that was powerful, and I applaud you for that.
Thank you.
Yeah. So talk to me about how your activism unraveled after that.
I think a pivotal moment for me was leading up to the 2016 election. Somebody on campus, it was a local NPR, like it was Ohio Public Radio, this reporter. I honestly don't remember how she found out about me, but she reached out to me and said like, that they wanted to do a story sort of like humanizing undocumented students and highlighting like why this election felt so big to us. Okay. And me and my other peers who like decided we're like trying to decide if we were going to do the story because it would be like a pretty public statement. And I did it. And then a lot of people who heard the segment on the radio or read it online, like messaged me on Facebook, both like allies and other undocumented people. Mm-hmm. And that was, again, very powerful. And so the day of the election, I mean, I did a lot of volunteering for throughout the election. And that was sort of my way of feeling like I was civically engaged. Mm-hmm. It was really cool. So Ohio being a swing state, a lot of candidates come to campus. Mm-hmm. So I got to see during the primaries, like Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, they had a debate on campus. Cool. And I got to go to that. It was like a CNN town hall. I got to go and I got to meet Hillary and I got to tell her that I was undocumented. And that was a really powerful moment for me too. Like just motivating that this person, I'm looking at my picture with her on my wall, that like this person who's running for president, when I told her who I was, like she stopped and listened to me and like told me how she felt. And that was really, it's just crazy to me. Like if you think about where I started in life, like just being back in Brazil with an unemployed dad, and like you feel like such a small, tiny part of the world, to then like be in front of someone who's running for arguably like the most powerful position in the world, and she's just listening to me like a person. That was really cool to me, and also like motivated me to do all the volunteering, because I was like, there are two very different people running for president right now. One of them thinks I'm a human being. The other one thinks I'm not. Mm-hmm. So it further like highlighted the urgency to me. And I remember like election day, it kind of felt like everything came like crumbling down. Mm-hmm. And somebody who I had never met, who had seen my, like my news story, on election night, like after Donald Trump won, this guy like messages me on Facebook and he's like, hey, I work for this immigrant rights organization and I don't really know what we can do going forward, but I think we should get together and talk. And like the night of the election, we all like me and a couple of other undocumented peers and this guy and this other immigration attorney, we just went to somebody's house and like talked about what do we want to do next. Mm-hmm. And planned a strategy for like what we want to do in Columbus. And we organized, we called it Grieve Together, like Stay Together or something, where we didn't want to call it a protest because we were like, you know, this sucks, but it's democracy. So we just organized this event for people who felt like they were like heartbroken to come together and be in that space, like supporting each other. And it led to like organizing a march in Columbus, Ohio, and then just doing a lot more informational stuff, like teaching regular people about who undocumented families are. Mm-hmm. And what we bring to the table and why our lives were in danger. And I just started doing a lot more like speaking engagements for stuff like that. And also pushing the Ohio State University to become a place where everybody could succeed regardless of their status. So
I wanna ask you, because you just said something important, teaching other people why your lives were in danger. How do you correlate that to the Trump campaign 2016 elections?
So, you know, we could think about it like that probably the same amount of people that hated immigrants before he was president are still there. Like, you know, like the deep-rooted hatred, he didn't make that up. He just kind of like ran with it. But we were in a very vulnerable state because a lot of us shared our stories for the first time during the campaign. So we put ourselves at risk of being targeted. And also, like, he made a lot of serious promises that he was going to come for us, that he was going to end DACA. Very early in his presidency, he got rid of the idea of like prioritizing certain people for deportation. And it was kind of like, you know, everyone counts. Like, it doesn't matter who you are, where you are. There was like stories of DACA recipients being detained. So like, it just felt like a very real threat that I was probably not going to be able to renew my DACA again. Mm-hmm. And that I would end up being separated from my parents, who are now, my parents are U.S. citizens now, through my sister. Okay. But because of our laws, like, I'm over 21, and I have unlawful presence, so I can't just adjust status. Like, they can't just pass it on to me. Like, people think,
right,
you know, that I'm just being lazy, or I don't want to apply, or I don't want to get a lawyer. Like, there is just no path. So, yeah, it was really just important to teach people that and teach them how to help others in their communities, because, you know, undocumented people, they have U.S. citizen children that need to go to school, that need to go to the doctor. So you have people driving without licenses who get pulled over, just taking care of their business on a daily basis, and end up being taken away from their children, or the other way around. So it was like really important to teach people that, because I think there are a lot more good people in this country than there are bad. Mm-hmm. I just think sometimes people don't realize that there is harm being done around them that they could help prevent.
Right.
And so if we help them see that harm, and if we teach them how they are themselves capable of helping stop that harm, like, we can live in a more harmonious place.
Sure. Of course. So, you know, definitely interested in this part of your activism, and we have about 10 minutes left. Mm-hmm. But so talk to me about, you know, so from this point to like being on stage at the Grammys, take me through, you know, from where you left off to that point. I'm interested to see the evolution of that.
Yeah. So, one of the things I did at Ohio State is join the Ohio State Freestyle Rap and Beatbox Club.
Awesome.
And I remember, like, for me joining that club, it was like a big social step too, because my best friends at school, they were both older than me, so they graduated a year before me. Mm-hmm. And I remember being like, I need to prepare for when they leave. I need to make other friends. So I like signed up for this club, and I kept like skipping the meetings because I was nervous. And finally I went, and it was just like a really awesome community, because it's a bunch of random people who like rapping and are sort of like on different places as far as their skill level goes. But everyone was always very effective at like giving constructive feedback, like feedback that actually makes you better next time. And so I really just started being involved in this group. And I've made music, like I've made beats like since high school. Mm-hmm. Definitely evolved. Like in college, I got a lot better because of these people I was surrounded by. So I started making songs, sharing them with my friends. It was also a place where I could like explore talking about my immigration stuff, because I could tell that other people would rap about really personal stuff and it was okay. And like, no one would press you about it if you didn't want to talk about it. But like, right. So I could spill all sorts of secrets like in a cipher, and no one was gonna, at the end of the day, like try to talk about it with me, right, if I didn't want to. So that was like a really powerful sort of like expressive avenue for me. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I just sort of became like, being a rapper was like part of my identity now. Mm-hmm. And
so I got the beats part. What about the actual lyricism part? Where does that come from?
Pretty early on too. Like, I started writing songs in high school. I've always liked writing. Like in school, I'd get really good grades on my essays and stuff like that. So all of that stuff just sort of evolved together. Mm-hmm. And in February of last year, so about a year ago, this producer reached out to a bunch of immigrant organizations because he wanted to make an album that featured a bunch of DACA recipients. So his name's John DeVersa. He's actually like a composer and like a jazz musician. So he had the vision for this project and he started reaching out to people. And so like, because it's always like something I talk about when someone's like, oh, who are you? What's your fun fact? So like a bunch of orgs that I had worked with knew that I was a musician. Mm-hmm. So they put me in touch with him. And it was a very long process. Like I talked to these people on the phone and they told me about this idea they had. And I didn't hear from them again for like 4 months. And then in the summer of 2018, they started doing all the recordings for the album. It was going to be called American Dreamers, and it's this jazz album. So there's really not a lot of like singing or speaking involved. It's mostly instrumental. Mm-hmm. But everyone got to like tell their stories as part of the process, because some people's stories are like featured on the recording. Mm-hmm. So I got to go in, and like it was just me and one of the producers, and I got to share my story, and then I got to like play some instruments in a few songs. Like I played the piano and percussion in different parts of the album. And like there are singing portions, but they're with the choir. Mm-hmm. So I'm like singing with everybody else. So I did this thing and I didn't know that like it was going to be this big deal. I just thought it was like a fun little project. Mm-hmm. And then in December, they invite me to go to New York and perform with them. And I got to perform my own personal rap song, like not a song that's on the album, but I got to perform my rap song with the jazz band. And I just got a lot of great feedback, like on the lyrics of the song. I don't know if you heard my song Alien, but that's, yes. Yeah. So like I got a lot of great feedback on the performance itself, because it's really cool to sort of mesh like rap and jazz. And we did a news segment promoting the album, and the reporter kept asking about the Grammys, and I remember looking around like, what is she talking about? But she knew a lot. She knew the producers more than I did, and she knew that like this project was a really legit high quality work of art. And like a week after that performance, the Grammy nominations came out and we were nominated. So it was like the craziest thing, and I didn't know if I was going to get to go to the Grammys or not, because there's a lot of us on the project, and I was like, I can't picture them being able to bring all of us. But like a week before the Grammys, the producers called me and they said like, hey, do you want to come? Like, we have a ticket. So I got to go, and we ended up winning all three categories that we were nominated for. And it was crazy.
Like, I mean, this is not a small thing. This is the Grammys.
Right. Yeah. It was amazing. Like, it was just crazy. And it was really validating for me, because when I was in high school, I still had ambitions of like making a living from being a musician. Mm-hmm. I wanted to go to school for music. And then I started like, I mentioned like those doubts that creep in. And I was like, maybe I'll double major in music and business. And in the end, I just dropped the music thing. Mm-hmm. But when I was in high school, I wrote an essay about how like one of my goals was to win a Grammy. And it was like something I hadn't thought about since high school. So like when we were nominated, I like found that essay on my MacBook and I showed the artist and I was like, look at this, like you just like revived this dream for me.
Right.
So for the past few weeks, I've just felt like really validated as a musician, and just have keep meeting people who like will take the time to listen to my stuff and give me feedback. And so I want to keep really pushing that and like spend more time on my art, because it sort of reminds me that like I'm more than my undocumented identity. And like, although me being an immigrant like informs a lot of my experiences and what I talk about, like it's not all of who I am. Like before I was an immigrant, I was a musician. So it kind of feels like I'm reclaiming that part of my identity, and it's really awesome. I'm like excited to see what I do with that.
Yeah, so in the beginning of this episode, we'll have had two snippets of your songs. So, you know, just give me a brief synopsis of, like, what does the song, number one, what does the song Alien mean to you? Like, what was the motivation behind it?
It was really just, like, owning my identity and not being embarrassed of it or being ashamed of it. But also being real about, like, the fears I had And it just like putting, taking that discomfort like out of my head and like out into existence is like a weight lifted off my shoulder. Mm-hmm. And it also like invites more people to know who I am. And that's both like random people, but also my friends and the people I was making music with. Cause like I said, it was kind of like, I would say a lot in the ciphers, but I wouldn't really welcome anybody to like follow up on the topics I discussed. Mm-hmm. But when I'm like, when I make the song and I'm performing it on stage and we're practicing together for a performance, like people get to be like, wow, like this is who you are. That's really cool. And it, to me, it's like, it's something that helps me initiate the conversation about my story. It helps me feel more connected to my friends. And it's also just like a really good song. Like I'm really proud of like the, yeah, the beat and that song and like the whole production of it. I feel like I'm someone who has a lot of ideas, and a lot of times I start a lot of projects and don't finish them. So like to have done that song from, you know, very beginning from scratch to the end, like this nicely produced record is like, makes me feel really good.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, so I have to ask you about the song Nobody Else. Mm-hmm. And what I will say about that song is that that song is a smash hit. That song is a banger. Like, I love it.
Thank you.
Tell me about, you know, the concept of it. What was the motivation behind that? Because there were a lot. I mean, it's just a song that really, like, grips you. Like, tell me about the motivation behind it.
Sure. So, like, that song was written over a long period of time, like almost 2 years. No, like a year and a half. The way it started is one time I was at one of my good friend's apartment, like on campus, and she had a high school friend who was staying with her. And we were just talking to him, and he's like, yeah, I make beats, like I make music. And I was like, I have like a whole setup in my apartment. Like, we should just go make music right now. It's like 2 a.m. on a Friday and everyone's kind of tired, but we were like, let's do it. So we go to I had this little corner in my room that was kind of like a studio, and he pulls out that guitar riff. Ooh,
sexy guitar riff.
And I'm just, the way I work is like, I just start freestyling. And then I like, if I say something really good, I'm like, wait, let me say that again.
Yeah.
So we're kind of both working separately, where like he's ruminating on it, I'm just saying stuff and writing it down. And he came up with the chorus. And so once we had the chorus, I was like, oh, okay, this is what this is about. It's like, it's sort of a love song, but it's like, we're like in the middle of like college, where there's like really weird dating culture, where like people want to be in love, but they don't want to really say that they're in love. And like, so I just started writing about it. And I like the line, like, this is so special, even though it's not serious. Like, right. That's kind of like the theme of the whole song.
But I'm really fucking feeling it.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, and I think, and when I mentioned that it's written over a long period of time, it's because like, I feel like the first verse of that song is very casual, like hands off, like, this is not that serious, blah, blah, blah. But by the second verse, I'm like, no, like, I want this to be like an exclusive relationship. So there's definitely like multiple people that came to my mind, like, during the time that the whole song was written,
right?
Because it took me so long to like finish it. And the thing is, like, I never saw my friend's name's Isaiah. Mm-hmm. I never saw him again, like, after that day.
Really?
Yeah. So he wrote the chorus and he wrote like a part of his verse, and I just had that recording that like we made the first night, mm-hmm, like sitting on my laptop for like months and months. And after I graduated college, I like pulled it out and added like the drums and the bass to it, and then like added more words and like kind of like decided what the whole song was going to be about.
How do you not have a music video for this?
I don't know. Like, I really should. I've never tried. Like, I've never really tried to make a music video. I don't have a lot of visuals at all. Like, I don't really have.
The thing is, I'm listening to this, like, you know, for the past few days, and like I'm on the subway and I'm imagining a music video for it, and I'm just like,
we should do something, you know? Yes.
But actually, so let me read you what I wrote to it.
Okay, cool.
97803, the restful digits reach me. I go high, they go low, immigration. MIC, I'm still a king, I'm still a don, I'm still a lion. Shit's still fun, but you gotta listen closely when you put your headphones on. Episode after episode, yes, it's a masterclass. Drink it, Henny, drink it fast, cause Henny's not just a glass. On the track with Daniela Vieira, Vieira. And she just won the Grammy, Trump no hables más mierda.
Ain't nobody really turn me on like that. Nice.
Yes.
I like it. I like the Grammy shout out.
Yes, you know, and I don't know if you got that very last part because it's Spanish. Okay, so when I say on the track with Daniela Vieira, Fiera, so Fiera, that's an old like Daddy Yankee song called Gata Fiera.
Okay.
Yeah, so that was the reference, like wild, you know.
Gotcha. I like that.
And she just won a Grammy. Trump no hables más. Well, the word is mierda in Spanish.
Ah, okay.
Yes. So, yeah. So, that's kind of like how it ties. Like, that's the punchline, you know?
I like it.
Yes.
I can send you the track, like, without...
So actually, let's vocals. Let's do that for the promo. I'd like that. So, but, okay, we'll talk about that afterwards.
Okay.
However, to end this interview off, Daniela, you know, it's been really fun. I want to ask you, like, what's next for you? And like, what are some words of encouragement that you have for people, you know, that are living through this political moment?
Oh man, I don't know what's next for me because the way I've always operated is like, I have like five parallel things that I could pursue as a dream, but like, I can only feasibly do them one at a time. So I just kind of keep pushing them all at once until something works. So like right now I'm studying to take the LSAT on March 30th.
Okay.
So like I'm thinking cool. About law school. I'm also looking to switch jobs because if I stay with my current job, I have to move to New Jersey soon and I want to stay here in Boston with my family. So I'm sort of like making my next career move. I work in finance. I've worked in finance for like 2 years now. So sort of like professional development is something I'm pursuing too. And I'm also I started this org called Mass Dreams, and right now I'm really focused on trying to start a mental health group for undocumented immigrants.
I feel like I have to ask you about that, like Mass Dreams. Tell me about it, what it is really quickly, like
I literally just started it because I sought support. Like I wanted to meet other, I like looked for an organization that was helping undocumented students in Massachusetts and I didn't really find one. So I was like, okay, so I need to start it myself. And my goal is to do really stuff with higher education. But I'm finding that my focus has shifted to mental health because I feel like I have some resources and connections that I can offer to people. So now I'm just trying to find the dreamers. So if you're out there and you're in Massachusetts and you would be interested in joining this group, it's like a support group facilitated by a mental health professional who's very informed in like immigration issues, and I would be there like leading it too. So if you know somebody's interested in that, reach out to me. And yeah, it's just something to support young undocumented people in the state of Massachusetts, pretty much.
Cool. Yeah, and you know, again, hopefully, you know, this interview and like the connections you make through this can like help out and you know, definitely be a part of that. And so, yeah, to wrap up, you know, any words of encouragement that you have at the current moment?
Just keep going. Like, it's so hard to predict what's going to happen. You know, we never knew DACA was going to be a thing. We didn't know it would last this long. So, like, just keep business as usual. Like, keep pursuing your goals as if you had a United States passport. And, you know, when you have to cross a tough bridge, you'll have to cross a tough bridge, but worry about it when you get there. Mm-hmm. Like if you're trying to go to school, if you're trying to be a lawyer, if you're trying to be a musician, like just keep going and ask for help. I think our community sometimes is very hesitant to ask for help because we feel like this country's already given us so much, but like we also give it a lot. And if you need help, like you have the right to ask for it. There's a lot of people with resources out there. And like I said, I really think there's more good people than bad people. We just got to reach out to them and let them know how they can help us.
Yeah. Well, with that, Daniela, you know, I want to say thank you so much for, you know, that closing message. I think it's really important. And I think it's really important how you offer yourself as a resource and to provide services. And, you know, myself as an ally, you know, I'm happy to make a connection and facilitate as we continue in this crazy run towards 2020. That's what I'm determining. And what's important is, you know, we spoke a little bit about the election, but it's going to not just, you know, impact Daniela's future. It's going to impact everyone. This has exposed how it's going to impact everyone. So I just want to, you know, we're all in this together. And thank you, Daniela, so much for joining me.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
All right. And that's the end of this week's episode. If you're interested in having me come speak at your school, church, university, panel, or conference about the podcast or my film, From One Mistake, which talks about my personal motivation for immigration activism that came out of a bias incident in high school, write me in the contact form at www.immigrationmic.com or just send me a message on Twitter or Instagram at @HandleOnTheMic. That's @HandleOnTheMic, and let's make some work happen. Till next time, peace.